You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It is the 23rd of December, 2020, and something just occurred to me. And what occurred to me is that from the very beginning, this show came into existence. In the Voice of Reason Network, sometime in 2008, I did exactly what I wanted to do. I talked about the topics that I had an interest in without a shred of interest relative to current events. I think my very first show was on the history of Ukrainian nationalism and socialism in the 19th century. The next show was on the political ideas of Brezhnev. So I had not a shred of interest in what was going on at the time, these topics, of course, being evergreen. They could be used anytime. Recently, though, because of how severe the problems that are, you know, not certainly were anything but unpredictable, have become, that I have shifted into a bit more focus on current events, which is irritating. You know, wherever I've gone, I'm usually the number one draw. All the networks I've worked for, every place where I've been a guest, I'm always either the number one draw or very, very close to it. And I have I always never could figure it out because this show couldn't be any more stripped down. It's just me. But I think at least part of the reason is that I talked about what no one else did. I did exactly what I wanted to do, and these are things that no one really even had access to, let alone had the background to understand it. I had a very unique education, such that I was in three fields the entire time. I was in history, I was in political science, and I was in philosophy, which is pretty tough to do when that means you have to master three specific academic methodologies to be able to get through 900-level classes. So, you know, and then by the time I did my examinations, it was, you know, I was all over the place because I had mastered three sets of literature. The problem is that at that point, I realized that these disciplines are very isolated from each other. They don't seem to know the other's existence. So historians make comments about modern politics without really having the background to deal with it. People in political science make historical comments using all the wrong language. And of course, one of the worst is sociology. The social sciences seem to go like this. They're parasitic on the two master sciences, which are history and philosophy. Because even theology is made up of both of those. You know, there is no theology without philosophy. You know, these are eternal ideas, and you need a certain Platonic language to discuss them. They take very old theories and completely misunderstand them, partially because I have no metaphysical background, and everything is based on a metaphysics, a type of metaphysics. They give kind of a one- and two-syllable version of what they think this is, give it a brand new name, and actually claim that they came up with it. That's what the social sciences are. So, for example, you'll see in your typical sociology textbook, you'll see something called critical theory. You'll read about it, and it'll be like a college freshman version of Marxism. It's like a kid who like took his first philosophy class and sat down and wrote a description of what he thinks Marxism is. That's what it sounds like. Because these guys have no philosophical understanding, really no political understanding. They're just, you know, trendy. They know how to work a regression analysis, and that's about it. They don't understand the metaphysics that this is based on. They don't understand the, you know, Ludwig Feuerbach's essential contributions to Marx. The fact that Hegel had nothing to do with Marx's development except in a purely negative point of view. He wrote several critiques, vehement critiques of Hegel's philosophy. People see the word dialectic, and they think they're talking about the same thing, having no idea what this word has, how the word has changed from Socrates and Plato to now. So you end up with this really awful college freshman version of Marxism, and then call it critical theory, and they say, this is what socialism is. And they give it a new name. And this is, it's all over the place. Nationalism. I've been through this before. They have all of the very pompous sounding names. Crisis management theory. You know what crisis management theory is? It's the notion that powerful people benefit from a crisis by bringing new political forms out of the chaos it creates. Where have you heard that before? And they're claiming that this is something they created. They take something that really we've been talking about for a long time, that either the regime creates a crisis or benefits from it, produces an entirely new system of thought because of it, because people are very suggestible in a point of crisis. And this is how they get what they want. Obviously, today's situation is an extreme variation of that. Now, let me be clear yet again. This has nothing to do with Hegel's conception of dialectics. I guarantee you, none of the people who use that definition have ever read Hegel. Most people can't read Hegel. I could barely. Hegel, I spent almost about half my time in grad school reading him and afterwards. Did my master's thesis on him and then my doctoral dissertation on Michael Oakeshott, who was the British leader of the British Hegelians, late version of the British Hegelians. So this is what they do, and they call it crisis management theory, as if they came up with it. So they take something they either steal outright or a much older idea. They mutilate it. They don't understand it because they don't have the metaphysical, but they don't understand what the metaphysics of these systems are, the historical background from which they sprang. So it ends up being, again, typical college freshman. He got really into this and now is very excited about it and, of course, doesn't fully understand it. That's what the social sciences are. Now, what's the point of all this? I want to talk again today about Alexander Dugin. There's no particular reason, except that Alexander Dugin is the ultimate example of someone who is always being cited, but never read. He's always being talked about to the point where the American media, who doesn't have the ability to comprehend a syllable, he says, just from a purely philosophical point of view, and claims that he is a major advisor to President Putin. As you all know from listening to me, that's not the case. I don't even think they know each other. He never had an office there. He was at Moscow State University. I strongly doubt Putin's of the mindset to understand his point of view on Heidegger. But it's something they invented because they don't understand him. He sounds vaguely threatening. They could put a label like fascism on it because, you know, that has no meaning, so they could put it wherever they want. You're supposed to be scared of that and say, oh, therefore, Putin must be either a fascist or a Bolshevik. Because now, all of a sudden, it's okay to be anti-Bolshevik, where for, you know, 40 years, it was out of the question. You were considered a Nathaniel if you were against Bolshevism. So I really want to return to what I used to do. I want to return to, for so many years, was a stock and trade of mine. And the thing that, for some reason, made me very well known. And I want to talk about national Bolshevism. Because it's a word that people use. You know, one of my big pet peeves these days, and I've taken like the Epoch Times to task with their anti-Chinese stuff, believing that because the word communist is in the name, they're doctrinaire Maoists. They don't have the first comprehension, first of all, what Leninism is, what Marxism is. certainly what anything that Maoism ever was, and certainly don't know what happened after Mao's death. As any fool knows, China is a national socialist state with a population more free in general sense than in the U.S. They don't have an imperialist foreign policy. Everything they do is to defend themselves against the U.S. They're a vehemently anti-liberal force. They don't persecute any religious group, unless, of course, it's one of these fronts, like they have in Russia in the 1990s, usually Protestant fundamentalist groups, and the payroll of the CIA. CIA has always used these religious fronts, especially the real Zionist-type Protestants, to promote their agenda around. I mean, even in Turkey, you have a guy in jail. I spoke about him at some length. One of these so-called ministers, and then you have these idiots going on about how the church is under attack. You know, Vladimir Putin threw a couple of these Christian scientists in jail for killing their kids, and you actually had a State Department or a U.S. Senate resolution saying that Christianity is under attack in Russia. In fact, I believe that was the cover of Christianity Today. This level of illiteracy, it has no excuse at this point. So, if I had a mission with all this, you know, I want to turn the deconstruction tables on those who try to use it against us and fail very badly. I'm a dangerous enemy of these people because I know their theories better than they do. They don't know anything about ours. They know our stuff only by caricature. They honestly believe that there is no good rational reason to believe what we do. They've never read it before. It's censored anyway, and they have no access to this information. They're not going to put the time in to understand what goes into it. Now, sociology in Russia means something different than it does in the U.S. It isn't this childish, liberal, positivist, conformist, dime store version of political science. There's nothing of the kind there. You can be, you can have a very strong philosophical bent. Sociology really is the metaphysics underlying any political system, almost the total opposite of what it is in the West. Social sciences themselves come out of the, you know, New School for Social Research, coming from the, you know, early 20th century, later became known as the Frankfurt School after World War II. This first 50 years of the 20th century, this Rockefellerite creation of new institutions, University of Chicago among them, and what they ended up doing is taking these awful, taking theories that they barely understood in the first place, and turning them into non-metaphysical, purely practical understandings, and which distorts them entirely. The point of what we're doing is trying to lay bare what are the assumptions in these theories. What is it about liberalism that makes it a totalitarian regime? And of course, it comes down to the use of private capital rather than the state to do a much better job of what the state failed to do in the USSR. National Bolshevism, because it's not understood, because no one actually reads this stuff, consider it some sort of a slightly left variation of National Socialism, which is something that most people don't understand in the first place. So it's a complete disaster. So this is something that's extremely important because Dugin is always being mentioned. And whatever happens, whoever the next president is, or whoever, if Trump continues or whatever, the foreign policy is going to be the same. There's a better chance of peace with Donald Trump, but as you heard from me many times, the laundry list of anti-Russian policies coming from the Trump administration is far worse than anything Obama ever did. Promoting Pompeo just by himself is sufficient there. So Russia has no particular interest. Biden has a history of being anti-Slav in general. He called, as some of you know, he called Serbs subhumans. And I have the citation for that. He said it on, I believe he said it on Larry King. I only saw it after the fact. So, he said it on, I'm pretty sure he said it on Larry King, and he's known for this. being very fanatically pro-Albanian. He had a lot of Albanian drug money. But ultimately, the foreign policy is going to be identical. So as this develops, and the regime is going to need war to climb out of the disaster that this hoax has put us into, you're going to start hearing more and more about Alexander Dugin. They're going to invent this, you know, sinister Rasputin-type figure based on Johnson's Law, as always, because they know that really no one can really read him. No one wants to read him. No one can. No one wants to feel stupid reading this and not know what's going on. So it's very easy to throw a trendy label on it and just assume that no one's going to read beyond the headlines, which is 99% of the time, especially in academia, is normally that's all you need to do. So I want to talk about this for the rest of our time here. Now, he's published on this. It turns out, you know, I translated his stuff, something called The Metaphysics of National Bolshevism. I didn't realize that the guys at 4pt.su already have a translation of that on there, so I wasted all my time. However, The Metaphysics of National Bolshevism is one of the things that he laid out to understand this theory and understand his general point of view. And the first thing you have to understand is that they don't define Bolshevism the way we do. The first job of a scholar is to try to understand how they're using words. 90% of the errors of the ignorant come from they're assuming what the word means, that a word has meaning. The word fascist has no, they have no concept. I mean, professors of political theory have no idea what fascism is. They don't have to know. They have to hate it. You take the labels off and everything is different. They even agree with this stuff if you don't tell them who the author is. But no one reads this stuff. What's the point? You're not going to get anywhere with it. So to try to understand what these words mean and not assuming that you know, especially when you're dealing with a society very different as, you know, post-Soviet Russia is to the U.S. Bolshevism has nothing to do with Marxism. And this is one of the first very striking things. I want to describe his theory here. Understand, I'm not necessarily accepting it. There's a lot to criticize about it, but at least it has to be understood. I reject the thesis that Bolshevism has nothing to do with Marxism. Bolshevism is one of the greatest manifestations of Marxism. Greatest in the sense that it's the highest, not that it's the best. It makes the most sense out of Marx. Marx never really explained what his society was going to be. Just, it was mostly criticism. And that's no accident. And even Engels added a little bit, but no detail. Because no one would accept it if they knew what the system really was about. So Dugin explains that, and this is something very vaguely well known, that there were a lot of debates on what the 1918-1921 revolution in Russia meant and who were these people that ended up taking over. But even, you know, most of your national Bolshevist thinkers generally despise Lenin. They really claim that Bolshevism didn't come into existence until Stalin. That the early Soviet society simply didn't have the central power, the economic resources necessary to rebuild the society. Again, even that's problematic, but I understand it anyway. Dugin makes the argument that the internationalist slogans of Soviet Marxism had nothing to do with actual policy, and which again is just not true. I've cited all of Stalin's internationalists, he was calling for a world government, calling for an international language. He did all of this. His condemnation of anti-Semitism, sending alleged anti-Semites to the Gulag. He did this for his entire reign. And the death penalty for anti-Semitic remarks was never rescinded. I'm not rejecting the theory entirely, though. It is useful. Because if you truly believe that Bolshevism is not connected to Marxism, then at least you can make a case. But afterwards, the National Bolsheviks were about preserving the nature of the state connected with the ancient tradition of Moscow. as a way to unify as many Slavs as possible in their endless war against the West. And so the National Bolshevik Movement tried to unify right-wing elements in the white movement. The white movement was far from universally right-wing, with some of the slogans, especially the Stalinist slogans of the Bolshevik Party. You had extreme left nationalism in places like Germany in the 20s, that the complete domination of Marx over the idea of socialism was not even complete by then, that it was extremely popular in Weimar Germany to connect socialism with nationalism in one kind or another. They seem to see this developing in the Soviet Union. You notice I never refer to Soviet Russia, unlike Dugin, because Russia was banned in the Soviet Union. The basics of her culture were repressed. Russia was sunk into this empire, and you weren't even allowed, any notion of Russian nationalism was violently banned. I have quote after quote after quote from Stalin on exactly this. My book, The Soviet Experiment, goes into that in great depth. But there's a group of these people. Ernst Nikisch, Ernest Junger, Karl Pittel, Hans Keres, all these people. Even Otto Strasser, to a great extent. All these people who should be a part of your vocabulary were a part of this movement that's very easily forgotten. The narrative, of course, is that, National Socialism is simply a right-wing movement. The socialist part has nothing to do with anything. It's simply beyond the day-to-day ideological language of your typical American or Anglo-American scholar. Now, Dugin's argument, the National Bolshevism is greater than this. It is unifying the best of both right and left movements, the notion of socialism and the notion of nationalism. So far, he's not different from what National Socialism tries to be. Now, he explains in some depth his problem with the so-called open society. You go to grad school especially for political science, you're going to have to read, usually more than once, Karl Popper's The Open Society and Its Enemies. And it's very painful. I read that only once. I read his book on Plato several times because it was so bad. And Karl Popper did a service in explaining what the degenerative qualities of liberalism, individualism is. The open society, and this definition has continued to be used subconsciously for a long time and continues today, that the individual as kind of an atom is the only thing in existence, coming from Thomas Hobbes, of course. There is no purpose. Logic rather than reason is dominant. And people build a life that they want, they see fit to build, unless it's us. But where they're getting the notion of building a life is a mystery, but they build whatever they please. And of course, what they don't tell you is that this only has to do with the state. Media capital, capitalism in general, advertising, that then takes over. There's never a void where people then can build whatever they want. Power centers, if one power center is removed, another one takes its place. So, and he's correct here. The open society comes down to rejecting the idea of an absolute truth. Except, of course, for individualism. So, but everything else, there's no absolute. That kind of childish relativism is just a weapon. They don't really believe it. You can't believe it, because you couldn't talk about relativism then. But it's a nice thing for, again, like freshmen in their first semester of philosophy, they could use it to justify their behavior. But the idea is a society is open to the extent that an individual can use his freedom to the maximum extent. Again, unless you agree with us, then you can't use it at all. But otherwise, you can't be against the open society in the open society. Again, which is something that he doesn't bother to mention. The opposite, of course, is coming from Plato's Republic, the totalitarian system. And so Natural Bolshevism has something to do with this, because Popper makes this identical division. There is one fundamental division in political thought, and that's between theories that put the state and society ahead of it, the common good ahead of everything, and those that put the abstract individual at the center of everything. Now, that exists only on paper because the individuals are radically different from one another. Warren Buffett, as an individual, means more than me. His opinions are that you have, you know, Bill Gates, who's making direct policy now. So to refer to individuals as atoms on paper has no relation to what individuals actually are in society. Some are simply a lot more powerful than others. And in an oligarchy, the individual is a joke. So the idea of atomism, the use of the metaphor of an atom, is that atoms go from one, you know, molecule to another. And they could, you know, they come and go. There's nothing permanent about what they do. And that's the same thing for an individual in this so-called open society. And ultimately it's a circular argument because he says the problem with common good systems or state-centric systems is that they violate the freedom of the individual, assuming that that's the nature of freedom, which they don't normally argue for. That the, as Dugin says, the atomic personality is all that matters, and anything that violates it is ipso facto negative. And again, Dugin is correct as far as this goes. Popper's book on Plato is a complete misunderstanding of him. Very selective, cherry-picking quotations and things. They're very typical. And then he'll talk about, you know, Schelling and Marx and Spengler, and which are very different people. So all of those have the one thing in common. They deny the principles of social atomism. And it doesn't make any difference whether these guys are on the right or the left. They're still enemies of the open society. So everyone from Lenin to Marx to Spengler to Hitler to Plato to Augustine, on and on, despite how different they are from one another, the only thing that matters is that they have that one thing in common. So put in very simple terms, Popper's enemies and the enemies of your typical positivist individualist, or everyone from conservatives to Marxists, fascists to National Bolsheviks. National Bolshevism comes exactly from the combination of what Popper claims are the enemies of the open society. So he says this, the most concise, the most central, most complete definition, the concept of National Bolshevism is a meta-ideology that unifies all opponents of the open society. And I was translating that as I was looking at it in the original. It's been translated differently elsewhere, as I've discovered. The concept is, what do all of these people have in common? So even this list I just mentioned. National Bolshevism, again, has nothing to do necessarily with Lenin or even Stalin. They may be manifestations of it. And it has nothing to do even with policy. It has to do with the foundations of that policy. The National Bolshevist idea, again, as Dugin says, is based on the total fundamental denial of the atomic personality. And what matters the most is the idea of absolute reality, absolute truth. Again, problems show themselves because Karl Marx did not believe that. Karl Marx was a Darwinist. His doctoral dissertation actually was on the atomists, the pre-Socratics, Lucretius, I believe. Actually, I read part of it a while ago. I think it was Lucretius or Democritus. So he rejected the notion of the absolute, but some of his followers rejected that, especially in Russia. But that's the one thing that they all have in common, is that the relativism of the individualist society is not even a society. It is not just something to be opposed, it's the very definition of what a society looks like when it begins to fall apart. So communists claimed to be opposed to fascism. Conservatives pretended to hate both of them, and they especially do that today. You have these people, you know, quoting Martin Luther King like he was, you know, someone to be respected. And that's the way, you know, they know what's coming, so they're going to start doing this. Again, I just saw in the Epoch Times quoting Martin Luther King, and I have the feeling I know why. If Biden gets in, well, they're going to start shutting down. They're going to have to start. You know, it's a problematic idea, and I'm noticing that conservatives usually do that when they get scared. They start, you know, promoting that. I just saw that recently, and they're not alone. I mean, this is one example. And but what we do, of course, is to oppose all of this and any concession to the regime's ideology, knowing full well that they're going to destroy us all anyway. So, but at least prior to World War II, these variations, you know, sort of even like right-wing socialism or left-wing nationalism, were flourishing. Very few people even know they exist today. But before World War II, and you know, the labels became much easier after World War II. And the idea was in National Bolshevism early on, even in the 20s in Germany and elsewhere, the uniting of everything to fight individualism. The National Bolshevik idea brought everything together in that list of people and their ideologies that undergird it. I reject that Marx shouldn't be there at all. But because the atomic personality is the same as a subjective personality, the subjective point of view is what's rejected here. And it isn't even so much, you know, the idea of you know, I suppose Marx's dogma of materialism kind of makes him that. But of course, Popper was the same way. There's always an absolute truth with everybody. The most hardcore relativist will call people like me evil. Suddenly, relativism doesn't matter. The hippie pacifists in the 1960s were burning down ROTC centers and still called pacifists somehow. No, they were just against the war, and so they took that label. It's just a weapon. It's an ideological cudgel. So there's more to this. There's more, especially in his eccentric definition of Stalinism, that there's more connecting him to the National Socialist idea than most people realize. Now, I've personally rejected that over and over again. I've quoted him at length many times. But the distinction here is between the individual or the collective, and the collective having nothing to do with the Marxist version, but collective meaning the communal, the common good, as being far more important than a subjective desire based on nothing from an individual. And usually they are based on nothing except immediate desire they don't even fully understand. I think psychology has just destroyed any sense of any rational motivation. But the idea is between then subjective and objective, even more so than individual versus communal. So the open society, and again, Karl Popper just kind of systematized it in a way that sociologists kind of liked. And he was very typical in that respect, because I don't think he fully understood someone like either Hobbes or Locke, but you know, those were his central positive figures. Individualism then is turned into an absolutist ideology, and that's kind of what most people can't comprehend. So you have this very strange idea of individualism being vehemently anti-individualist when it comes to people like us. They become totalitarians when you see these very same people demanding we be shut down. Now, occasionally you'll find a, you know, like an ACLU type, and they've suddenly shut up, and they're very much told what to do anyway. But the one of those types, one of the libertarian types, will say that you can't really shut them down. You need to let them say what they want because they're so irrational that even ignorant people will eventually see that they don't know what they're doing. They've never read our stuff. They have no idea what we do. Everything with them is a caricature. Now, the concept of Bolshevism, again, this is in Dugin's theory, came out of the debates within the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party and what Lenin's place in this was. Lenin's view, of course, was the most extreme radicalism possible. a vanguard conspiracy. And so the communists who carried out the October Revolution, which is a very small group, began to be called the Bolshevik movement. But then, once they took over, and once they began building a bureaucracy, once they began building their own system, it ceased to have that purely conspiratorial meaning. And it began to refer to the majority of, allegedly, the majority of the Russian population, something based on some kind of national integration, as Dugin would say. Again, I completely reject this idea. The Bolsheviks had nothing to do with anything Russian whatsoever, and they fought everything Russian with everything at their disposal, and leading, you know, primarily against the Orthodox Church. Dugin rejects the idea that this was primarily a Jewish ethnic movement, which, of course, at the time, it was considered this, especially outside of the country. He makes the claim that Bolshevism was defined erroneously by the West. I'm trying to tell him that the West didn't know the first thing about, but they didn't define anything. But the last thing that anyone in the West understood was what Bolshevism was. And now Dugin comes now and claims that National Bolshevism and Bolshevism are the same thing. And it became a radical revolutionary attack on liberalism. Well, that might be true. That doesn't mean that it's anything other than the difference between a collective ideology and a communal ideology. Those are not the same. The Bolshevik movement completely rejected any sense of community. They rejected any connection with labor. They rejected any sense of worker control over industry. They rejected, farming in Russia had always been a communal enterprise. No, the collective is what happens when you break all those institutions down. You have nothing but alienated individuals, and then you recollect them. And this is kind of reverse dialectics here. You recollect them into a completely alienated a group of people held together entirely by force. It's kind of like the U.S. is. People who have nothing in common with each other. They don't speak the same language. They have nothing ideologically in common with each other. It's not a nation in any sense of the word, and it's held together largely by force. Force and drugs, and now fear. But there are, and Dugin admits this, that there's fully leftist traits. And the fact that he has to argue this, of course, communism is a leftist ideology. It's never been anything else. Just like capitalism, it appeals to abstract rationality, but not reason. It appeals to logic only. It appeals to linear progress. It appeals to the basic concepts of humanism. Some vague understanding of equality that were rejected, as soon as they took over. And then Dugin says this. He says there are aspects of the Bolshevik movement that are opposed to the left. The irrational, the mythological, the archaic, the totalitarian. There is nothing archaic about Marxism or Bolshevism. There is nothing mystic about it. There's nothing mythological about it. And they claim to be purely the apogee of the Enlightenment. And he claims that this actually existed in Bolshevism. I've yet to find it. They were pretty strict in supporting Karl Marx and how his very vague ideas of what society is going to look like after they take over in an industrialized country, which, of course, Russia was. Karl Marx personally said that Russia would be an excellent place for his ideas to begin because of the communal system and farming. So in that sense, they rejected Marx entirely. Russia was an industrialized country. It was very rapidly. It was already had a communal structure in certain things, the labor artel on the one hand and the commune on the other. And Karl Marx believed that this is one of the reasons Russia was an excellent place for the movement to start. So you have this myth today Karl Marx meant it for Germany or England, not for Russia, and that's simply not true. Dugin makes the claim that only Feuerbach's ethics falls out of the Bolshevik, is rejected by the Bolshevik ideology. And that's about the last thing Feuerbach is essential. You can't read Marx without understanding Feuerbach in the first place. So it's a desperate attempt to try to claim that a Soviet Bolshevism has something to do with the mystic, the Third Rome, in a different, more modern guise. And you simply can't do it. You can't find those ideas. And of course, you know, they'll even say, well, you can't find it, but it's there. They have no idea of any of the eschatological, the apocalyptic. They had nothing like that. There was nothing sectarian about it. Now, it's true there was such a thing as the utopian socialist movement, many of whom were very rational, very, very decent people. There's nothing mystic about that, though. It simply functioned on a communal rather than a collective foundation. Now, some of the utopian projects were legitimately based on the esoteric movement coming out of the Renaissance. That had nothing to do with socialism, however. The fact that it wasn't individualist is not enough to make it a socialist construction. One of the errors that Dugin makes in this whole idea is that there's enough that these ideologies have in common to build a super ideology on top of it. And it's so vague that you simply can't do it. And the claim is that they took, you know, the Christian eschatological idea and made it rational, which is pretty strange if this is a mystic movement. And, you know, you had all these miracles. Dugin talks about, you know, controlling the weather, which, of course, the Soviets tried to do. The community of wives, showing how sexual this means, simply the sexual revolution. People can fly, all that kind of thing, from the Renaissance onward. Claiming that this had anything to do with Western end-of-the-world ideas. So now he's right, of course, about Hegel. He was an extreme reactionary. But the dialectical idea here, according to Dugin anyway, is a traditionalist and eschatological idea, and he's absolutely correct. Hegel's philosophy is a version of or a philosophical version of the traditional Christian idea. And it came, so the absolute is alienated from itself, and it manifests itself in the world of objects. Objectifying into history the absolute idea acts, and, you know, creates a world, a mental world, predetermining this fabric of the event, as he would say. But the Son of God opens up this brand new apocalyptic idea. And the awareness of absolutism then becomes purely subjective. And so Soloviev said the same thing. It's not just a utopian idea. It becomes fully present and aware. And there was, with him, of course, the empire manifesting this, which was supposed to be Prussia, although he was very vague about that. I think that's mostly mythical. Prussia was an example, but not the example. Difference between the Antichrist and Antichrist, or an Antichrist. Those are two separate things, although they're based on the same idea. But we're not talking about, and, you know, with his epistemology, is connected with ontology. And again, he's right about that. Logic is simply formality. It's based on cause and effect relationships, and no one denies this. But Hegel changed everything by making it purely ontological. The potential aspect of a thing that is normally inaccessible to everyday consciousness. The fact of an object or a proposition is, well, you know, that the statement of it is simply one thing. Denial, as formal logic will see it, and then a mode of existing that's above reason or above logic. And which, of course, to some extent comes from Kant in the first place. The synthesis, of course, embraces both affirmation and denial. But that's extremely simple. If more detail there, you simply can go to, I did a whole lecture on that topic. Apparently no one listened to it because the idiots keep claiming that's what Hegel meant. And I should note that in Hegel's philosophy of right, he doesn't mention Prussia at all. And certainly, identifying anything with the kind of the earthly kingdom, the New Jerusalem descending, is nowhere near anything even vaguely Hegelian. Again, the ignorance of him is overwhelming. Now, shifting this to Marx, remember, Marx was 13 when Hegel died. Marx, of course, spent most of his time in the British Museum. And he noticed there was a similarity between the utilitarianism of Adam Smith, the idea of this progressive movement towards this idealized version of the market, with, of course, money being this universal solvent, which, for Marx, has some correspondence with the idea of antithesis, which is the alienation of absolute truth and as it's manifest in human history. And he correctly identified what that alienation is. And it's just how incomplete the open market society was, because it universalized money as the only thing that existed of any value. If it wasn't quantifiable in money, it simply didn't exist, which is, of course, basic to capitalism. It's also basic to Marxism and basic to Soviet communism. So he analyzed the structure. And Marxist early writings are not terrible in this respect. You learn a lot about capitalism in the 1848 manuscripts. But that's very early. And Dugin calls this the mechanics of alienation. And he does refer to it as an alchemical formula, how this antithesis of the money world comes about, and that is a necessary condition in Marx's world to the very last revolution, which was the communist revolution. This communist society was not a matter of progressive movement, but it was the final one. And again, capitalism says the same thing about itself. The whole end of history nonsense. So the initial stage of human development is what he would call very primitive communism. The antithesis of that is capital. The final synthesis of it is world socialism. So it is an end of history thesis, but so is capitalism. But to remotely connect that with the Gnostic era of the Holy Spirit is only proper in a sense of analogy, and nothing more than that. Materialism was an absolute for Marx, no different than money is for Adam Smith, because there is no market without money. There has to be a way to measure demand. But there is a weird sense of a magical transformation after this revolution. Now, that was denied by Frederick Engels, that's why he rejected the utopian idea. So there was a Gnostic element to Karl Marx. That doesn't mean there was a Gnostic element to the Bolsheviks. Or if it was, it came from the Jewish side of things, which Dugin doesn't mention. So this Gnostic line, Dugin claims, was taken up by the Bolsheviks, trying to make the claim that the so-called sectarian movements, the turn of the century, Russia, the secret societies, the messianism, and all this, the romance, somehow was connected with the idea of Bolshevism. Mostly people weren't Russian in the first place. Russia being the third Rome, the bearers of God to the world, can't be connected to the idea that the Soviet Union, not Russia, is a bearer of atheism to the world. Except simply the fact that they made these absolute statements. The content, there's nothing in common. The fact that it's an absolute statement is all there is, and that's not enough to connect them whatsoever. So ultimately, he says, this was the line that triumphed. That's what Bolshevism became. Now, he then says, well, this is the case in North Korea and North Vietnam and in China. In China, he's right, but that has nothing to do with Bolshevism. That had to do with the national reaction after Mao died, the rewriting of the Constitution, the rebuilding of the economy, and the purge of the party of all Mao's supporters, which apparently no one has, you know, has noticed. These theories require a certain ignorance of historical reality, especially from the modern right. The third world communism tends to be national socialism, but when you're ignorant, labels are all there is. The claim that that Bolshevism is right wing communism is laughable. If that were the case, they wouldn't destroy the church. They wouldn't be so Jewish centered. They wouldn't be purely international. Not to mention the fact that their economy was built by the West. They may have used Jewish Gnostic sources. But that doesn't mean a damn thing. That has no connection to legitimate mysticism. Now, we also know that the idea of the nation is something completely different. I've always used the term to refer to cultural and political and religious as well. The economic, then as a result of it, and biology comes into existence only because people marry people of the same language and who look the same. So you can't have nationalism without the ethnos, as I talked about at some length. But you can't talk about, the atomic individual here. That's the opposite of nationalism. The fact that both certain forms of Bolshevism and nationalism agree with that doesn't mean that there's any more content to it than the abstraction. And Dugin claims that, and he may be somewhat correct here, that the Bolshevik idea was imperial and to some extent geopolitical in the sense of the Atlantic versus Eurasian distinction, land versus sea. No one in any sort of major policy position ever made that argument, however, in the USSR. In places like China, that's certainly the case. And even in Cuba and Vietnam, their education came from, in Vietnam and Cambodia, they were educated in France. Now, one of the more competent of the Eurasians or even national Bolsheviks is Ustrelov, and I have a whole lecture on him. Who kind of redefined the idea of nationalism as super ethnic, that it was a geopolitical point of view, a civilizational point of view rather than an ethnic one. The problem is that civilization is simply too great. It creates unifying entities, but they're too abstract to build a society on. The idea of a continental empire to fight liberalism and capitalism is something that was around in Germany and in Russia prior to the revolution. And the geopolitical understanding comes from people like Haushofer in Germany and, of course, the Russian Eurasianists. So the Eastern peoples, with Russia as its center, become the center of this continental state. Ideology does battle with oligarchy. And the word plutocracy was first coined there. Socialism can mean something that's communal. It could mean something that's collective. They have nothing in common except they're not individual. Although collectivism relies on the individual. And of course, for people like Nikish and others, the Third Reich is supposed to be a socialist Protestant world that's genetically connected to the Slavic world. But not, places like Bavaria and Austria. So this idea of nationalism really ruins the word. You can't talk about universalist messianic claims without having a religious and ethnic foundation. There's no ethnic foundation without a religious one. It's rare to find an ethnic group that's successful with more than one religion. It simply doesn't work that way. Because religion creates the fundamental moral assumptions that people have to function in day-to-day life. But the nation was understood by these people in the same way that the so-called Russian populists understood it. And that's an integral organic being that can't be fragmented and still remain what it is. Any identity is based on the rejection of individualism. Well, the Bolsheviks had no identity. And they also were opposed to liberal individualism. That's why this fails completely. Now, the so-called mystic element of nationalism is to take what is a practical cultural unity and tease out the metaphysics behind it, that there is this somewhat mysterious personality of a group of people that's tough to make purely quantitative. It was something which comes out of Hegel, the national mind, which, you know, breaks down through the market and then is reconstituted with the idea of cooperation. The idea of the nation, either ethnic or civilizational, allegedly is supposed to be both acceptable to the national Bolshevik point of view, although they are very different from one another. So to claim that old Moscow and Bolshevik Moscow have anything in common because of the rejection of liberal individualism is to say absolutely nothing. A legitimate ruler of a country and the leader of a gang that takes over have a lot in common. They both rule, they both have a police force, they both have power, so they're the same. They have nothing in common. One's legitimate, one's illegitimate. One's based on a constitution and tradition, one's based on violence. The fact that they have a lot in common does not mean logically that they're the same or even comparable. The things that they have in common are purely symbolic. We're using the same word to describe what they do, but even there, it's equivocal. That's not what we mean. There is no such thing as Russo-Soviet nationalism, since the Soviet Union rejected all forms of nationalism. So the whole notion of the national Bolshevik ideology does fall to pieces. And to integrate the different, you know, Slavic nations of Europe into a socialist state has nothing to do with the integration of Orthodox national bodies into a single church. They have nothing to do with each other. One is purely idealistic and traditional. The other one is very Jewish, very and completely fragmenting. You can't talk about the integration of a people once they've been fragmented into individuals in the first place. You destroy their culture, then bring them together through force and claim that's the same thing as a culture that was destroyed. This is an extremely poorly thought out idea, and this isn't uncommon. Any form of Russian nationalism was violently rooted out in the Soviet system. You can't be a Russian nationalist without being Orthodox. That doesn't even make sense. The whole idea of what Russian is grew up in a purely Orthodox environment. That's what the monarch was. The fact that a socialist dictator, a pure materialist, an atheist, at war with the society that he rules over, is the same as the traditional forces that they overthrow, solely because they rule and they're against individuals, their individualism is illogical. It doesn't make any sense. There is nothing in the Soviet idea that was anything pro-Russian. But going back to Popper, it's exactly this kind of irrationality that he defines as the center of the closed society or the totalitarian society. But by reason, he's referring to that which is amenable to numbers. We call it to operationalize something. Well, how do you operationalize alienation? How do you operationalize community? You simply can't do it. And therefore, they have absolutely nothing in common. To use a word like nationalism to cover all of this stuff, you know, civic nationalism and ethnic nationalism have nothing in common. Neoconservatism and conservatism are their enemies. The use of the same word is designed to deceive. It's designed to manipulate. This is the problem that unfortunately the National Bolshevik movement doesn't understand. But that's a historical claim. Now, it doesn't mean that certain elements of that movement can't be used in rebuilding a new society. But certainly Marx is not at the root of it, and certainly Lenin is not. You did have right-wing Bolsheviks. They were an eccentric minority who were purged very early on. That didn't mean that they didn't have something to say, though. But they have nothing to do with the Soviet system historically. But as a foundation, at the very least, they protected the Russian population from liberalism. And the introduction of liberalism destroyed that system. So they went from the frying pan into the fire. So ultimately, the historical argument for national Bolshevism fails at 1,000 different levels. And one of the reasons it fails is from equivocation. The mere fact that an ideology rejects the idea of the individual as a foundation of society is not enough for them to have anything in common, let alone build an ideology based on it. Dugin is a brilliant man. He says many true things. He's been a rock-solid inspiration. But when it comes to romanticizing the Soviets, that's for the Stalinist system, that's where the line has to be drawn. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.